You're listening to Radio MD. She's a chiropractic holistic physician, best-selling author, international speaker, entrepreneur, and talk show host. She's Dr. Suzanne Bennett. It's time now for Wellness for Life Radio. Here's Dr. Suzanne.
Attention Deficit Hyperactivity Disorder, ADHD, is a mental disorder that most often occurs in children. Now, symptoms of ADHD include trouble concentrating, paying attention, staying organized, and remembering details. Now, it can also be difficult to diagnose. The rate of ADHD cases and diagnoses have been increasing in the past few years, and the CDC says that 11% of American children ages 4 to 17 have this issue. And this is an increase of 42% within the last 8 years. Now, I wonder why it's going up. Today on Wellness for Life, we have Dr. Michael Feld, MD. He's a psychiatrist from Northbrook, Illinois, who's been in practice for 29 years. He's here to shed some light about some new information on ADHD. Thank you for being here. Welcome, Dr. Feld.
Thank you. My pleasure.
Absolutely. Can you please give us a description of what ADHD is?
Okay. ADHD is a neurobiologic disorder that presents with some main symptoms. The key parts about ADHD would be symptoms that include inattention, distractibility, with or without a high level of hyperactivity, and a high level of impulsivity. And the impulsivity can include emotional impulsivity. These core symptoms cannot be accounted for due to other reasons or other causes. So there are neurobiologic pathways in the brain that tend to, you know, obviously not be working as well in people who have ADHD, and they experience these symptoms. And ADHD is diagnosed when a combination of these symptoms interfere with functioning in more than one area of a patient's life.
So when I said earlier that it's a mental disorder, it's actually corrected by saying that it's a neurobiological disorder.
Yeah, well, most, you know, all psychiatric disorders are truly neurobiologic, as far as, you know, what we call Axis 1 disorders. So ADHD is a documented neurobiologic disorder.
Right, so it is a real disorder. Now, you know, I know a lot of individuals who can be in that spectrum where I don't think they would be considered ADHD, but they're in that milder spectrum. Do you see that a lot?
Well, we do see it, but the good thing about the psychiatric diagnostic criteria is that the latest criteria that came out describes ADHD on a spectrum. So obviously a clinician that's capable and good at diagnosing ADHD will have to figure out whether a patient is mild to moderate to severe ADHD. So we are actually seeing a greater openness to seeing what mild ADHD would present like.
And I'm even seeing that, I know, you know, they say that a lot of times the diagnosis is as a child when you're young, but I see adults that have ADHD as well. Do you believe that it's started as a child, they just wasn't diagnosed, and they were diagnosed later in life?
I mean, there are adults that aren't diagnosed. But yeah, I do know that if you look closely at how you diagnose ADHD, in most adults that are diagnosed, you will see evidence during their childhood about symptoms of ADHD that were apparent that might have been compensated for or not severe enough to be interfering. So we do see adults that present with symptoms of ADHD that weren't diagnosed, but in carefully looking at them, almost every adult will have evidence, you know, in childhood and in adolescence prior to when they were diagnosed of ADHD symptoms.
Mm-hmm. Now, you've been practicing for a really long time. Are your patients mainly children?
Well, I mean, I am a child and adolescent psychiatrist, but we're trained as adult psychiatrists first. So I would say that the vast majority of my patients are adolescents and young adults, but I actually, you know, treat children and older adults also.
So when you see them, you know, give us a description of how you handle a child. I mean, obviously, parents bring a kid in because they're concerned. Their school might have told them something's going on here, and take them to a doctor. What do you usually see? How is it presented to you?
I mean, are you talking about someone that's coming to me to be diagnosed if the child has ADHD or not?
Yes, okay. Exactly.
So obviously, as a psychiatrist, I'm fully aware that ADHD is a clinical diagnosis. So what you see with the kids presenting is you see where these symptoms are potentially interfering, whether it's in school, socially, in sports, in religion, in the family situation, through the use, if they're older, maybe related to substance use or driving difficulties. But what you have to look for is you combine a lot of clinical evidence maybe with other evidence, including we look at their academic performance. Some kids will have neuropsych testing. Some kids will have computerized testing that, like, shows whether someone might have ADHD or not. There might be some radiologic studies. But in general, you look by history, not only interviewing the child, but interviewing parents and looking at school records. You look to see what the level of symptoms are, like I told you, the inattention, distractibility, impulsivity, and hyperactivity. And then you look to see how it's interfering and what maybe has been done to try and help that wasn't working.
You know, it sounds, obviously there's many, many different steps. It could take a long time then. It could take a long time for you to really diagnose it properly.
Well, I mean, yeah. I mean, obviously the more experience you have, the more you know what you're looking for, but I don't diagnose it in the matter of one session. You know, it usually takes a few sessions, and then I'm asking to get other information that I'd like brought in, whether it's school records, communications with teachers, previous testing, whether there was IQ or neuropsychological testing, and you're looking for obviously points of data in different areas of their life. So you know, I don't rush to the diagnosis. The most important thing also is to rule out other causes of maybe inattention or distractibility and make sure that there aren't other things that account for it. And then we also know, you know, fortunately or unfortunately, there's, if you know what the concept of comorbidity is, a lot of ADHD children have a higher risk of other mental health problems, so we have to rule those out also.
Right. And you mentioned that there are other causes of these types of symptoms. What do you see? What kind of causes?
Non-ADHD.
Yes.
I mean, there are multiple medical causes. Even someone that's sleepless and doesn't sleep well could look inattentive or distractible. Kids that have thyroid problems or issues with blood glucose problems or even issues with digestion, like celiac sprue disease. And then we also know that, like, depression and anxiety and other mental health conditions present with symptoms that can also, you know, be similar to ADHD, because an anxious person is often easily distracted or having trouble paying attention, and depressed people experience similar stuff.
Mm-hmm. Now, are there genetics ties, like if a child has, you look at it as the parents or the grandparents?
I mean, is ADHD a heritable disorder?
Yeah.
No, ADHD is clearly a heritable disorder. And I think if you look closely at the data, there's many genetic markers that have been found. And the heritability rate of ADHD, the heritability quotient, is thought to be 0.75 to 0.8. And the last thing I saw was around 0.78. Height, the heritability of height is something like 0.85. So if you understand the heritability, a child that comes in my office that I know has ADHD probably has approximately a 40% chance of having one biologic parent who also has ADHD.
Right. I work with methylation a bit, and there's actually an enzyme called GAD, G-A-D, that converts glutamine into glutamate. And I find that often people who've got anxiety, hyperactivity, they actually have that variant, methylation variant, GAD. And do you at all do any kind of blood tests to check on any kind of those inherited mutations?
No, occasionally I will do the genetic testing that looks at kind of metabolism, how medications would be metabolized, including what you're talking about with the methyl. So I do that in kids that I am having struggles with how they're tolerating medicine. So that we can do genetic studies, but they're mostly related to how how the medications are metabolized, and that gives you evidence of whether you're concerned that a child would maybe have early side effects or would not respond to a med because they would need higher than FDA approved doses. So occasionally I will use it, particularly if I'm struggling to have a child respond well to the medications.
Got it. And what kind of medications are available? I know they've, you know, many years ago, Ritalin was the first. What type of medications are out there now?
Well, psychostimulants are considered first-line treatment of ADHD, and there's two categories of psychostimulants. There's Ritalin is methylphenidate, and there are methylphenidate medications, and then there are also amphetamine-based medications. And obviously there's been a tremendous amount of development and research and new products coming out. And most of the new medications that have come out are variants of newer delivery systems, ways to get these meds to last longer and hopefully be more tolerable and more consistent throughout the day. So you're seeing the development of new medications that are either amphetamine-based or methylphenidate-based.
You know, going back to right now, people are going to go back to school. You know, right now they are, all the kids are going back. What are the important aspects that parents should know? What should they look out for their kids, just so that they can see whether or not they need to get the child tested, making sure that they can have a really happy, relaxing and fulfilling school year?
Oh, absolutely. I mean, obviously, the earlier we see something in a school year before a child falls behind or has early lack of success is important. So if we're looking at ADHD, parents have to look for reports from the child themselves, reports from the teacher, evidence they see around the house of the child struggling with inattention and distractibility, and that leads to working memory issues, organizational issues, not getting homework done, not paying enough attention in class to be organized. And then you also see evidence of hyperactivity and impulsivity, and a lot of these kids can be disruptive and impatient and causing other problems in class and even in the playground or lunchroom or outside of school. So I think it's really important for parents to have early contact with teachers if there's any concern, and then obviously keep track of how the child is doing in class and how they're doing with their work outside of school.
You know, do you do this? Do you ever do psychotherapy with these children?
I actually do. I'm actually a psychiatrist that I would tell you I'm not just a pharmacologist, but I obviously use a lot of medication, but I do some psychotherapy, yes.
And, you know, kids, I just adore. I see a lot of children in my practice. We work with a lot of allergy issues and environmental allergies as well, and food allergies and all that. And I love working with them. And of course, there's a way of discussing things with them and talking to them. And how is it, you know, because you're going to sit there and talk to them for how many minutes do you usually talk to with a child?
Well, the therapy sessions I do, which may differ from other therapists, tend to last around 40 minutes.
How long? 40 minutes?
Yes.
Wow. So what's going on? I'd love to get your take on how you run your one-on-one visit.
That's a great question. But honestly, it's really about the connection and what I'm seeing with each kid in the room and how I'm trying to get them to honestly trust me, know that it's a safe space, and then be able to be open about the things we need to talk about. The common thread of any kid that comes in my office, whether they have ADHD, depression, anxiety, or other mental health issues, is that a lot of what has happened has negatively impacted them, and they come in a lot with self-esteem and competency and confidence issues. Kids who have ADHD tend to get a lot of negative reinforcement. They're obviously told that they're not being successful, they're not smart, they're annoying, they're obviously being often told where they're causing problems or where they're meeting lack of success. So a lot of what you have to work on is helping them set a place to build success, how to understand the ADHD, the medication, and the environmental issues and behavioral issues and strategies that we use to help them, but then also help them address how they're feeling about themselves and how they can start to feel more comfortable and more confident.
Absolutely. I mean, I know that a lot of young people turn to sports because it's something that they get rid of a lot of their excess heat in their body, their excess excitation, and sports can help them feel better physically and help them with their self-esteem and confidence in their abilities of who they are. Do you suggest that too?
Oh, well, one, I believe exercise is critical. I mean, exercise helps almost everybody, but we know exercise is also helps with attention and distractibility and impulsivity. But I also extremely positively believe in sports, not only for the structure and the predictability and scheduling of it, but also the success and, like you said, the everything else that comes with playing competitive and active sports on a team and working with other kids and following authority. I mean, I'm not to tell much about myself, but I actually was diagnosed. I have ADHD myself and played sports in high school and college, and would say that it was critical to my success at being successful academically and getting to the point where I could go to medical school.
Right. I know for a fact, when I was younger, my mom and dad said that I came out kicking, like wouldn't stop moving, you know. And I lived in Korea. I was born there, and we all slept in the same room, and that's just part of our culture. We would sleep in the same room, and I always ended up being on the end because I would move in my sleep. Even I was super athletic. And I really believe I had the same thing as I've had attention deficit. Not so much where I couldn't concentrate because I loved school. I loved athletics. But my brain worked a little too fast. So my brain worked faster than my mouth. You know what I mean?
Yes,
and
I do.
And often I would start to like stutter, and not stutter as much as stammering. You know, it's amazing that I have a radio show now, Dr. Feld, because I would have never been able to do this, let's say, even 4 years ago. And once I discovered about my methylation issues and looking at all of my genetic defects and my, you know, variants that relates to the dopamine receptors like COMT and the serotonin and all these other, mutations, you can say. Once I addressed them, things started slowing down. It was really fascinating, very fascinating. But I also find that a lot of my friends are all very similar. They're all very smart, very bright, and way ahead of their time. You know what I mean?
I do. No, I think a lot of ADHD, I think of ADHD as a very exciting thing if you can be successful, because most ADHD adults that I know have high energy, are pretty active, and are obviously the ones that have good intelligence are very sarcastic and witty and enjoyable to be around. So I think it's great to be around them. But that's the key to ADHD, is obviously this is where we use medications first line, and we use other strategies second line. That the key is to just help people be successful and not have functional problems in different areas of their life.
Right. I know that for me, and a lot of my patients, what I recommend is a change in their diet because of the neurotoxic effects that certain types of foods, you know, excitotoxins that can affect the brain, such as gluten and casein, among other things. Do you recommend that for your young people?
Yeah, I actually do. Actually, obviously, the one of the things I look at immediately on every child is sleep, exercise, nutrition, and even light exposure. But what I've learned a lot about ADHD and other disorders is that I think everybody has food intolerances, whether they're food allergies or food, I don't know what people would label them, like things you're talking about. But when people really look at their diet, they realize when they take certain things out that they are less tired, less irritable, more focused. So part of even when we use medication as first-line treatment, you really still have to help people work on what their nutritional strategies are best for them. Like you said, I know people that when we take gluten out of their diet, it really does help with focus and energy and distractibility. So I absolutely try and get people to look at. The hard thing is, when you work with kids, is to get them to strategize and be willing to look at food and be disciplined. You're working with ADHD kids who are kind of impulsive, and they like to eat what they want to eat when. And so the younger kids don't often follow the food strategies. The adolescents and young adults and adults, a lot of them that are successful, buy into the idea that they should really see what foods they tolerate and what foods they do better with.
Even the little ones. I mean, I see all various pediatric ages, and even the little ones, I find that they can tell. They know. They will tell, you know, their mom that they don't want to eat some food because they can feel it in their body when they are feeling uncomfortable and
right.
and not feeling, you know, themselves. And nowadays, these young people are so brilliant. They're so smart. It's incredible how well they can express their feelings and talk to you with clarity and you know, truth. They really know how to connect with themselves. That's why I'm so happy to hear that you do a lot of psychotherapy with them, because they do amazing things. You mentioned something that was very interesting. You said that you work with light therapy. Can you explain that a bit?
Well, I actually look at light exposure. We know that there is a, you know, condition known as seasonal affective disorder. But when, you know, I'm based in Chicago, and we do see, I see in a lot of people I work with, just a certain level of irritability and tiredness and fatigue and other symptoms that occur, like when, let's say, the beginning of the winter and during the winter. And when you look at, you know, like what's going on with kids nowadays and how they, how much exercise do kids really get? How much light exposure do they get? What do they do on the weekends? A lot of kids, unfortunately, go to school when it's light out and come home when it's dark. And then on the weekends, when they wake up later, they go right downstairs to their computer or game system in a dark basement, and they don't get the necessary light that they need. Because we do know that like light exposure is a key component of mood regulation.
So you're actually talking about natural light.
I'm talking about natural light, but also there are lights that are a certain wavelength that can be used for people that truly have seasonal affective problems and need more light exposure. And I do use that as a treatment for some kids and adults who we know each year you can see trends over years that at certain times of year certain symptoms escalate. And so we do actually use light therapy for a bunch of patients.
That's great to hear that you use this natural remedy, because I've been using light therapy. Gosh, I'm in California, and back in like 30 years ago, I experienced seasonal affective disorder. I couldn't believe, and that the reason was because I was indoors all day. I didn't even have a window where I worked as an intern. And back then, I was fortunate enough to find a little instrument that you actually wear like a visor, and it had little light fixtures on this visor that shined into my eyes. And every morning I had to wear it to get my body back up, break my brain up, and so that I can get out of this depression mode that a lot of these people have, as you're saying. And it was a godsend. I'm telling you, even still to this day, I use a light box as soon as Halloween hits. My light box is out, even in Southern California.
No, I believe it, but there are there are companies that make some really great products, including visors and different sized lamps and kind of sleep alarms that wake up and wake up with a light starting. So right, there are a lot of products that can be useful for that. But you know, I wish most kids and adults that have it, I wish these products really did help. You know, with the majority of these kids minimize their symptoms, but. Like I've noted before, we know that with this neurobiologic disorder, it truly the psychopharmacology is a key way of treating ADHD symptoms. But like you're acknowledging, we have to look at other stuff and use other interventions also.
Right. Now, when you're saying about the medications, it specifically is there to trigger a receptor in the brain that's not being activated. Is that correct?
Well, I mean, what we know they do is they interact with certain receptors in the neurons that help regulate the amount of dopamine and norepinephrine that are available to help the nerves work more efficiently. So it's a little more complicated than what we know from rat studies, but the medications improve the amount of dopamine and norepinephrine available to help nerves communicate and fire properly in different areas of the brain.
Why is it that then you cannot, why not look at using the precursors to dopamine, for instance, tyrosine?
No, I know. I do.
Why
think
is it that it doesn't, yeah.
I just don't, I think people do try that, but it's just not as effective. The psychostimulants that have been created, the amphetamine-based ones and the methylphenidate-based ones, they are clearly more effective at immediately improving these functions.
You can see a big difference.
So you see a more profound and more immediate effect. It doesn't mean that people shouldn't try the precursors and the tyrosine. I just don't think, one, I think they need to be further studied, and two, I don't think you see as remarkable a response as you do with the psychostimulants.
Yeah, there's no doubt. I mean, I have children that do come to my office who's already been on them, and their studies, their ability to focus, they go from D's and C's to A's and B's, and I've seen miraculous changes in some. Some do, though, you know, what they suffer from is they can't sleep very well. They don't have a really good appetite. How do you help the side effects of that?
Well, one, you hope that they don't experience too much side effect. The nice thing about all the evolving treatments and developments, the new medications that come out, is you now have more medications to use that hopefully they won't experience these adverse events. So one thing is to be willing to try different medications with different delivery systems to see if the child experiences the same side effects. The other then is to obviously be careful and adjusting your dose to really try and minimize, you know, maximize positive effect and minimize adverse events. And then if you really do have appetite issues, a lot of what you do is you work behaviorally and environmentally to help ensure that the child eats, and you help the child and parent and the adult understand when their appetite is going to be low, when it's going to improve again. Because the medications only make the appetite lower while the medication's working, and they only work for so many hours a day. So you can help figure out how to eat before, during, and after. And then sleep, there's ways to help address, but it's a very low incidence of people who take psychostimulants that truly have insomnia. It's not as high a number, I think, as most people think. So you don't see true insomnia as much as you think on these medications. And if you do, you obviously have to work with try other medications or try other treatment interventions.
And then, you know, do young people, when they do take these stimulants, for the ADHD, do you believe that they need to take it for the rest of their lives?
Oh, absolutely not. I mean, the nice thing is we're learning right now that there are, like you brought up earlier in the show, that we know that there's about 4.5% of adults meet the criteria for ADHD. So sometimes the ADHD symptoms lessen, or people really learn how to use other strategies and find careers and lifestyles and do everything else that we've talked about, that the symptoms aren't interfering as adults. So most people do not take these medications throughout life. So when I prescribe meds, I'm really just looking at trying to help the child. You know, the time that we're prescribing the meds, we're not looking long term. We're looking for them to have success now.
Well, God, such great information. Really loved having you here, Dr. Feld, Michael Feld from Northbrook, Illinois. Thank you so much. This is Dr. Suzanne sharing natural strategies for ultimate health and wellness right here on Radio MD. Until next time, stay well.